right, Dave. I suppose we are on to... We're still scrambling, but we are away from Africa.
Yes.
I've thought of calling this mini-series. I mean, who knows if it'll be mini, knowing us. But the Scramble for Oceania. What do you think? Oceania? Is that how you say it?
Yeah. I mean, in many ways, it's part of the Scramble for Africa because they are grabbing all of the, you know, in quotes, unoccupied lands.
Yeah. And it's motivated, as I'll we'll say when, in our roundup, by the same
exactly the same ideology. Military bases, prestige, resources, trade.
So we're going to do Australia first. I'll tell you, I found some interesting readings, a little bit like indirect. It was I did actually find one just about Indigenous resistance, but why don't I'll say them as they organically come up. So you're going to start us off.
Yeah, and we have the usual disclaimer. This is not meant to be a comprehensive history of Australia. It's more how the history of Australia connects to the scramble for colonies in the late 19th century.
Yeah, we are not experts on Australia. We do. I know we have some Australian listeners, so you know, I'm sure we'll do our best. Tell us how we did, okay?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. So we know now that Aboriginal people arrived somewhere between 50,000 to 65,000 years ago, and these people were known as the Torres Strait Islanders.
These
are later arrivals, ethnically and culturally distinct from the Aboriginal people, and they came from Papua New Guinea maybe 2,500 years ago. So that was my first eye-opener, is that the Aboriginal people are not, you know, one monolithic culture, but probably many. And the Torres Straits Islanders, they settled in the Cape York Peninsula on the northern tip, which means that they were the first ones, you know, discovered by European explorers. So 1606, a Spanish explorer, Torres, discovered the strait. But the Dutch were already there. Willem Janszoon had landed, and there were more than 20 Dutch explorers who sailed around the west and south coasts of Australia. And they called the continent New Holland. The name didn't stick. But one of those explorers was Abel Tasman, and his name did stick, Tasmania, named after him. And quite a few of these voyages were encouraged by the governor of the Dutch East Indies, a fellow named Anthony Van Diemen, D-I-E-M-E-N. And his name stuck too, Van Diemen's Land.
Was that U2 song? Which...
Yeah. Yeah. And then Captain Cook showed up and charted the East Coast in 1770, and he recommended a nice landing spot that would be ideal for a settlement at Botany Bay, which is today Sydney. So, well, he had a good eye anyway.
So before is this the same Captain Cook who died in Hawaii?
The same guy.
Oh.
The guy who discovered half of everything? Yes.
Well, again, as I always say when I recall that story, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
So before the European arrival, the Aboriginal population is estimated to have been between 500,000 and 1,000,000. If you've been to Australia or seen pictures of Australia, it wasn't really built to support a massive population, at least not in the style that they lived. And again, not the Aboriginal peoples with an S, divided into about 600 tribes or nations and 250 distinct languages with dialects on top of that. And that blows my mind as well. That's an incredible number of languages. Apparently their society was egalitarian. They didn't have formal government or chiefs. Authority often rested with the elders. They were semi-nomadic and generally ranged over fairly specific territories, usually defined by natural geographic features.
So this is a fascinating area of, I guess you could say, like environmental history. So I mentioned Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe. It was like multiple subtitles. It's the first edition, 2014, is Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident? And then he changed it to Dark Emu, Aboriginal Australia and the Birth of Agriculture. So he's, I mentioned this, he was arguing that indigenous land management in Australia was actually extremely sophisticated and suited to the unique ecosystem.
Right.
And there's another one from 2011 that I read in yesterday night, Bill Gammage, The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. And this one was really fascinating. I think it's a similar argument, but I think maybe I just got a little bit more out of Gammage. It's a little bit more directly written. You know that style of writing where somebody says, I was flying over the, you know, and down and I saw that kind of vibe.
Approach.
And Gammage is a little bit more like this book has three claims. <You know? laughs> Like, all right, let's do it. So that's more my style. But Gammage says basically, prior to 1788, so 1788 is the 1492 of Australia, right? So it's like the contact or the, you know, European arrival. But prior to 1788, Aboriginal land management involves the sophisticated use of fire. So 70% of Australia's plants either need or tolerate fire, which is like not true of Europe or most of Asia, you know, other continents. It's a pretty unique thing. So Aboriginal land managers would burn in very specific patterns to create regeneration favorable to grazing animals. And the grazing animals have a unique situation because they don't have like wolves or big cats, you know, stalking the grasslands for these herds of grazing animals. They just kangaroos or whatever. They the only real predator was humans. And there's a quote. He says, "There was no wilderness. The law, an ecological philosophy enforced by religious sanction, compelled people to care for all their country. People lived and died to ensure this." And, you know, obviously the European stereotype of Australian Aborigines was not this. They didn't get it. They thought it was all wilderness and people were just, you know, primitive and didn't understand anything, whatever, the usual stuff. But some of them did. So there's a quote from Edward Currer, C-U-R-R, who was like, Gammage calls him a pioneer squatter, who spent 42 years in Victoria, Australia. And he wrote this. He said, "It may perhaps be doubted whether any section of the human race has exercised a greater influence on the physical condition of any large portion of the globe than the wandering savages of Australia." So he's basically, Gammage argues that the whole continent was managed as a single estate, and the scale is important. So he's basically saying like the way to manage, he's also, both Gammage and Pascoe are arguing that Australia needs to get back to this because like Australia is just one ecological disaster after another since 1788. So they're both, I mean, Gammage is arguing that if they want to avoid, you know, a future of ecological catastrophes, they need to understand deeply how Aborigines managed the land, and they managed it on this mega scale. So there's like a lot of evidence that he presents that I obviously can't present here, and a lot of it is visual. He goes through colonial writings, he goes through 19th century landscape paintings, really interesting analysis of the paintings in the book. Huge sections of just like, look at this painting, look at these species, look at the edge between these two ecosystem types, that kind of thing. Because he's basically like, these paintings are a kind of evidence. And then, you know, ultimately he can, where he, you know, he concludes, I guess you could say, that they are not, you know, they were very sophisticated. He says, in most seasons, Aborigines had plenty of spare time and spent it nourishing the mind more than the body. Art was voluminous and intricate. Imagine a dot painting on sand several meters square, composed of different colored feathers, most of them tiny, stuck down with blood. Songs were long. Corroborees might last months, initiations years. Not only in their parks did people think and act like gentry. This hardly reflects people constantly on the edge of want. They cannot have been the scavenging, chance-dominated savages Europeans thought them. A rich and time-eating spiritual life builds on abundance, not poverty. In the driest and most fire-prone continent on Earth, abundance was not natural. It was made by skilled, detailed, and provident management of country. So, you know, it was fascinating to me because, like, we talked about North America a little bit, you know, the buffalo, the beaver, the the way that in Hawaii, you know, the fish ponds, the taro root, the different ecosystems that were really carefully managed by indigenous people, and the balance was destroyed by these colonization. But I'd never gotten into it for Australia. And you know, what you point out about the low density of population, Gamage argues, or suggests at least, he says, outside cities and towns, Australia may have carried more people in 1788 than now. Observers thought so on the Murray, the Murrumbidgee, and the Dawson. In 1788, only 10% of Australia's people lived in its arid third, but only about 3% do now. Gilmore wrote that the invader, who lived off the land's teeming life, never realized that less than 50 years later, with a population more sparse than that of the Aboriginal he displaced, fish were no longer caught in profusion, and meats had to be taken from the farm and the home paddock.
Are these writers suggesting that the Aboriginal people practice some sort of population control?
No. Not on the contrary. It was not exactly population control. It was sort of like they were really well attuned to, I guess, what they could get and what they could support. So there's like, he talks about like a philosophy where they managed to ensure that there was like an abundance of game at all times. And like, so, you know, presumably there is some sense of population. And there was, I mean, he also talks about,
they don't have a history of, you know, violence and land theft and murder and competition for scarce resources, which, you know, given the European view of them, you know, wouldn't you expect that?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And they do have, obviously, everybody has warfare and everybody has violence and stuff. And some of their intra-tribal warfare actually came in handy when they were fighting Europeans, as we'll see. Mm-hmm. But you know, yeah, exactly. So the typical attitude towards them was not an appreciate. It was not that of like the Edward Kerrs of the world or whatever, the Gilmores. The Sydney Herald says this vast country was to them a common. This is a 19th century article in the Sydney Herald about why they needed to take their land away. This vast country was to them a common. Their ownership, their right, was nothing more than that of the emu or the kangaroo. They bestowed no labor upon the land, and that only is what gives a right of property to it. Where, we ask, is the man endowed with even a modicum of reasoning powers who will assert that this great continent was ever intended by the Creator to remain an unproductive wilderness? So Darwin, who doesn't use God, he doesn't evoke the Creator, he called Aborigines a set of harmless savages wandering about without knowing where they shall sleep at night and gaining their livelihood by hunting in the woods. So pretty, these new histories of the environment in Australia are really strong refutations of the racial beliefs of the time, which were, of course, intended to justify their displacement and the theft of all their land.
Yeah, and still being used.
And still being
used. The persistence of that type of argument is rather stunning.
Yeah, yeah. Especially since, like, this whole labor, putting labor on the land, which is like, you guys don't, you guys aren't doing the labor. The people who own, who took the land from the native people aren't doing labor right now. They're no. having other people do the labor for them.
No. Yeah, there are so many similarities to the history of the Americas, North America particularly, but there's a direct connection as well. The American Revolution directly impacted the exploration and settlement of Australia, because from 1718 to 1775, the British used North America and the Caribbean as like an overflow, especially for their convicted criminals. So they, just a reminder that they didn't have prisons in that sense of the word. Prison or jail was a place that you went awaiting your either to be, you know, declared innocent, which was pretty rare, or for your sentence to be carried out. And the sentence was often a hanging for even minor offenses, or you know, a public flogging or things like that, or public mutilation, this sort of thing. So prison is not a sentence. It's just a place we hold you while waiting to carry out your sentence. But the British discovered that, you know, there were other options, including sending these convicts as labor to the New World, forced labor. Well, they sent 50,000 of their own people to the New World as convicts in the 1700s. And with the American Revolution, that overflow valve is now shut off. So we are looking for an alternative. Where can we send these convicts? Which, by the way, include not only petty criminals, but political criminals, particularly the Irish. One temporary solution was floating prison hulks. So these are decommissioned naval vessels or just old rotting ships. And they've been stuffed over capacity, and they've turned into a public health hazard. More workhouses, that's an expense. We don't want to spend any money on this. One alternative that was explored was sending convicts to Africa. From 1775, they'd already sent convicts to garrison some British forts in West Africa. But that, like in the Gambia, but that proved unsuccessful, because what usually happened is if you dump a bunch of convicts, say on a small island in Gambia, and, you know, tell them, okay, support yourselves, what you're basically creating at no expense to the government is a colony of thieves, which you can't control after a while. They also looked at sites in Namibia and considered them briefly. But that Ooh. Changed. Yeah, that would have been interesting, right?
Yeah.
In 1779, Sir Joseph Banks, this is a famous scientist, he sailed with Captain Cook on the 1770 voyage, and he had also seen Botany Bay as a suitable site for a settlement, and why not a penal settlement? So Sir Joseph's plan was to send 200 or 300 convicts to Botany Bay, dump them there, and leave them to their own devices, so they won't be a burden on the British taxpayer. Now, there's a historical debate about what the real motives for doing this were. There are trade possibilities. There are strategic considerations. You know, even 100 years before the scramble, some of the reasons for doing this are the same. They were also looking at the outbreak of a civil war in the Netherlands, and it might lead to another war like the one that they were experiencing in the American Revolution. If you remember, France, Holland, and Spain all allied to declare war on Britain. And that was the major cause of their defeat in 1783. You know, it's not like the Americans won the American Revolution. It's more like the French, Dutch, and Spanish did. So if that happened again, the British thought, if we have a naval base in New South Wales, that would make it easier to attack Dutch and Spanish colonies in the region, so like a privateering base or a pirate base. But when they did set up the penal colony, the instructions to the first five governors are very interesting because that's not what they were instructed to do. Trade, shipping, and shipbuilding were specifically banned in order to keep the convicts isolated and so as not to interfere with the monopoly of the British East India Company. Can't step on their toes. So subsistence agriculture is your route forward. So there was no long-term plan for economic development, other than can this area produce raw materials for Britain? That's about as far ahead as they thought. By 1788, they had their expeditions planned, 11 ships carrying more than 1,000 settlers, 778 of them convicts, 192 women and 586 men, and Governor Philip was given complete authority over the inhabitants. And this guy, I don't know if he had specific instructions to do this, but his plan was to establish harmonious relations with local Aboriginal people. And he had long-term plans. I don't know what religion he was or what kind of a moralist he was, but he wanted to try and reform and discipline the convicts of the colony. Early efforts at agriculture were difficult, to say the least. Supplies from overseas were scarce. Many of the new arrivals were sick when they got there or unfit for work. And they didn't get better. With the hard labor and poor sustenance, many of them got worse. By 1790, they were reaching a crisis point. The second fleet, which arrived in June of 1790, had lost a quarter of its passengers on the way through sickness. And then a third fleet arrived, and the condition of the convicts on board were so bad that the governor was appalled. So between 1788 and 92, over 4,000 convicts were landed, 766 females, 3,546 males, and they were all landed at Sydney. Eventually, they made Tasmania a secondary site for transported convicts. They started to spread out. They got farms on more fertile lands. By 1803, the colony was self-sufficient in grain. And they started building boats to make travel easier and, of course, to fish and exploit the resources of the seacoast. Sealing and whaling became important industries. Did you want to mention your source here?
Oh, yeah, just, yeah. I found The Fatal Shore, which is actually primarily about the convicts, but there's interesting stuff about the relations between settlers and Indigenous people in there.
Right.
So, right. Yeah, I'll intersperse with your...
Yeah, I just found Governor Philip interesting. So, unlike the view that you occasionally take where everything's directed by those shadowy... Yeah. And, in the closed rooms in London, he seems to have, had his own plan, his own blueprint for how to go forward. Not saying that it worked out really well, just that. What's very interesting is that the very first convicts who landed there had different ideas than Governor Philip about the way forward.
Is there like an ethnic bias? Like, are they deporting Irish mostly, or is it
about
something...
one quarter of them were Irish?
Okay, which is disproportionate.
Pretty high, yeah. Pretty high. Well, and these are sometimes petty criminals, and when I say political criminals, I don't know if you remember the episode on the famine. We talked about things like ribbon men.
Yeah.
So when the landlord is evicting the poor old widow, the ribbon men would go at night and tie a ribbon around the door as a sign to the landlord, don't push us too far and don't evict this poor old lady.
Yeah.
Or bad things will happen. So if you're outed as a ribbon man, free trip to Australia.
Right.
It's like union organizers, right? We don't want these guys causing trouble. But the first convicts, the ones who survived, did well because, you know, there was a high demand for skills of any kind. Some of these convicts became lawyers, architects, teachers. And when their sentences were complete, or if they earned a pardon, they were granted a small plot of land. And then later convicts had to labor on the farms of earlier convicts. And when labor was limited, as it was early on, the convicts were actually paid wages. So by 1821, convicts and emancipated convicts and their children owned about two-thirds of the land under cultivation, half the cattle, and a third of the sheep. But as they brought more and more ships full of convicts there, the numbers transported were increasing all the time, era of the French Revolution, there was now surplus labor, and that changed everything. Because we don't need you as much, therefore the food ration for convicts could be cut. Wages, or even the opportunity to work for wages, was restricted. Many of the convicts were assigned to work gangs in rural areas, and the governor set up isolated little settlements of convicts, established as like a place of secondary punishment. So you're misbehaving? Well, we're going to send you out here into, I guess, what is considered the wilderness, and you have to stay there. They had some form of leave, and I don't understand how it worked, but there were tickets granted, I guess, by the governor for leave, and the rules for that tightened up. The rules for land grants were changed, so rather than giving them to emancipated convicts, the rules were skewed in favor of free settlers with money. So if you're a convict that arrived after 1820, you're far less likely to have become a property owner, to be able to marry, and to establish a family. So early arrivals did better, later arrivals, not so much.
It's basically like a generation, eh? Like 1788 to 1820 is about 30 years.
Right. And you mentioned the ethnic division. So conflict between the convicts and their government, their overseers, started early. The, I guess, religious services were only provided to Anglicans. And the quarter of the convicts who were Irish, obviously mainly Catholics, asked for priests and didn't get them originally. There was a rebellion, the Castle Hill Rebellion, led by Philip Cunningham. So he was an Irish rebel who joined Wolfe Tone in 1798. On his way to Australia, organized a mutiny on his convict ship, was punished by being sent to a prison farm in Australia, escaped and gathered a group, and they were going to try to capture a ship or ships and sail them back to Ireland. So the governor declared martial law in the colony. The rebels who had gathered reinforcements, I think it had spread and it was no longer just the Irish. They were hunted by the colonial forces and they took refuge on a hill or a small hill, Vinegar Hill. This is in 1804. And while negotiating under a flag of truce, Cunningham was arrested. And honestly, I laughed out loud. How many times have we seen the British do this? Right. Let's have a flag of truce. We'll negotiate. And then under the flag of truce, you arrest the leader of the opposition. I mean, this goes back to the Wat Tyler and the Peasants Revolt in the 14th century. You know, you hear about the Russian playbook in Ukraine. Well, it appears that the British playbook is to offer a flag of truce negotiation and then violate.
Yeah. I mean, the truce. How many times did they do that in Africa?
In Africa, yeah. Yeah. So once Cunningham was arrested, the troops charged, the rebellion was crushed, and 9 of the rebel leaders were executed. So now, obviously, we need a permanent police force. So they created the New South Wales Corps, a permanent regiment of troops, I guess, to take over the duty from the Marines on the First Fleet. And these guys immediately got involved in the rum trade in the colony. So corruption spread through the New South Wales Corps, and a lot of money was being made. So the governor at the time, named William Bligh, yes, the captain of the Bounty from the Mutiny on the Bounty episode. So the mutiny happened in 1789. By 1806, Bligh had been made governor of the Australian colony. So he tried to suppress the rum trade, also tried to correct illegal use of crown land and the corruption. And that turned into another rebellion against him in 1808. It's called the Rum Rebellion. And the New South Wales Corps, rather than suppressing the rebels, they actually launched a sort of a coup. And working with a wool trader named John MacArthur, successfully took over the government, an armed coup. So the only successful coup in Australian history, from what I can tell. Bligh was deposed, and you had a brief period of military dictatorship, I suppose.
Wow. Until,
yeah, interesting. Poor Bligh. he obviously didn't take enough management courses.
No. I don't think they'd had started the Harvard MBA at that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure it would have helped.
Or Oxford. Where did I guess? Who knows where he would have gone?
So a new governor arrived in 1810. This is Governor Macquarie. And he was there for 11 years. He set up a bank. He organized the first currency, built a hospital, roads, docks, and sent explorers into the interior. Most important, though, he decided to treat the emancipated convicts, the ones who had finished their terms or had been pardoned. He thought that they should be treated as equal to the free settlers in the colony. And this was an important decision. I think it, you know, prevented a great deal of opposition to the government, because he appointed many of them to key government positions. So now the opposition came from the free settlers who didn't want to share. And I don't know if it was, you know, snobbery or economic interest, but they certainly did not like the idea of emancipated convicts as their social equals. Macquarie got into trouble with London as well, where they were alarmed by how much money he was spending. Obviously, you know, a bank, hospital, docks, roads, going to cost some money, and he was, I guess he was over budget. So they began an inquiry, and Macquarie decided to resign before the results could be published. So another example of the man on the spot, I guess, not pursuing a policy approved in London.
Yeah, he was a little too softy, too much of a softy, I guess.
Too progressive? I don't know. Yeah. So by 1820, there were around 26,000 settlers in the Sydney area, 6,000 more in Van Diemen's Land, which soon became known as Tasmania. And over the next 20 years, they found so many more convicts. Another 55,000 arrived in New South Wales, and 60,000 were sent to Tasmania.
So what's going on here? Is this like post slave trade, or, you know, post-American Revolution, or post-Napoleonic War? Like, what's going on there? There's so many...
This is an episode or a period of British history that we covered with the reform movement.
Yeah.
So yeah,
all of the above.
The Industrial Revolution, union organizers, you know, extreme poverty people,
Jacobins, maybe British Jacobins.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But strangely enough, in New South Wales, free settlers and people who were locally born outnumbered the convict population. So the natural birth rate was obviously pretty high. And you had a large number of people who were no longer convicts. And I guess they decided that they would avoid government control and escape the cost of licenses by setting up sheep farms of their own beyond the official limits of the settlement. So the governor had drawn a line and said, you do not go beyond this line. And you had squatters doing exactly that. Does that sound familiar to you at all?
Oh my God. How many times have we done this? South Africa, America.
Yeah, I was thinking of the Americans crossing into Indian territory. And yeah. So by 1850, population of New South Wales was 180,000. By then, there were 70,000 more in Victoria and 5 million sheep.
Which is, see earlier note about ecological disaster.
Yeah. So with numbers like that, obviously the expansion began. A military garrison was sent to Western Australia in 1826. Partly this was to keep the French out. And they formally annexed that area, set up the Swan River Colony in 1829, which included Perth and Fremantle. And this was entirely convict-free. This was entirely private colony settlement and the first of its kind in Australia. But much of the arable land was sold or granted to absentee owners. And I don't know how much of a study they did before they chose the spot. The soil was poor, the climate was dry, and they hadn't invested enough money. They were trying to do it on the cheap. And of course, without convicts, they didn't have access to cheap or free labor. So by 1850, that colony had only about 5,000 settlers, and then half of them apparently were children. And then they began to accept convicts because of the shortage of labor. So what started as a free settlement quickly turned to convict labor to get ahead. And again, this is trying to set up colonies or settlements with private investment and little or no cost to the British government. They were definitely penny pinchers.
And so it's interesting too, because I guess the difference with convict labor and slaves is convicts' children are not convicts. So
and the convicts have exaggerated ideas about
their station. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in these new settlements, power was often divided between the crown back in Britain and a board of commissioners and then shareholders. For the Swan River Colony, there were about 300 shareholders. So these are all the stakeholders.
But it's not like a company, eh? It's more like a government project.
But the government doesn't want to run it directly because then they would have to assume the costs.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of a shared administration.
But a little different. Every colony is a little different, eh? Like it's a little different from Canada or
yes. India,
South Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of these new places, Adelaide, for example, the plan was to have a generous provision of churches, parks, and schools, and to ban convict labor to make the colony more attractive to respectable families, and also to have a more even balance between male and female settlers. And the land was to be sold at, they call it a uniform price. I'm guessing that means fairer. And then to use that the proceeds of the land sale to find labor somewhere and what they called selective assisted migration. In some cases, they granted religious freedom, commercial freedom, and occasionally, surprisingly, a guarantee of the rights of any Aboriginal natives and their descendants to lands that they now actually occupy or enjoy.
Oh, is this all under Macquarie, or is Macquarie gone and passed?
Macquarie's gone.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Brisbane in Queensland began in 1824 as a penal colony. Then they opened it to settlement in 1842, but the settler population was still pretty small. And this is when frontier violence between settlers and the indigenous population started to become more severe. So I mentioned Macquarie sent out explorers. The British had been exploring the continent quietly at first. And the reason they did it quietly is they didn't want the convicts and settlers to think that they could safely venture beyond the official limits. Again, don't cross the line because, you know, it's dangerous out there or bad things will happen to you. But there were several mapping expeditions. The Surveyor General, Sir Thomas Mitchell, sent out a bunch of expeditions in the 1830s to fill in the gaps left by the first expeditions. Mitchell employed three Aboriginal guides, and he was apparently meticulous in recording the Aboriginal place names around the colony. I think his spelling was phonetic, but, you know, since many of these place names...
Which is a really interesting thing to be doing at this time, eh?
Different. Very different. Rather than pointing his finger and name, you know, what is that? And then naming it whatever he wanted.
Yeah.
But he also resembles later explorers. In his records, he mentions a violent encounter with the original owners on the Murray River in 1836, in which his men pursued them, shooting as many as they could.
That's more what I would expect. Yeah.
In the 1840s, a German scientist, Ludwig Leichhardt, led three expeditions in northern Australia, sometimes with the help of Aboriginal guides, identifying the grazing potential of the region and making some important discoveries in botany and geology. But he and his party disappeared in 1848 while attempting to cross the continent from east to west. Another explorer, Edmund Kennedy, led an expedition into Queensland in 1847. He died there, speared by Aboriginal people in the Cape York Peninsula. And there's a whole history of these brave explorers. Burke and Willis, the first north-south crossing from Melbourne to the Gulf of Carpentaria. They didn't want to learn, apparently, from the local Aboriginal people, and their bushcraft was somewhat lacking. So Burke and Willis died in 1861. I think they were late at the rendezvous point. The guys that they were supposed to meet had left a few hours previously. And they became tragic heroes. Their funeral attracted a crowd of more than 50,000. And their story, you know, was made into books, artworks, films. So popular culture, Burke and Willis are celebrated as brave explorers. I don't know. It seems to me that they're kind of an example of what not to do.
Yeah. In fact, I have a long passage from another book, Henry Reynolds' book about Aboriginal resistance to colonization of Australia. And there's a great passage I'll just read now, a part of it, so I can cut it out of later. But he says, we major figures of our history will have to be reassessed. He's writing this in 1981. Frontiersmen who lavished lead on neighboring clans, selectors who notched the handles of their Colt revolvers as readily as they ring-barked rainforest trees, jolly swagmen who at night became far from funny, shagmen when they staggered into Aboriginal people's camps. The high evaluation of explorers needs amendment. They were usually dependent on the expertise of their Aboriginal guides. They followed Aboriginal paths, drank at their wells, slept in their gunyas, and were often passed from clan to clan by people who constantly monitored their progress through a landscape the Europeans chose to call a wilderness.
Yeah, yeah. And then you've got this example of Burke and Willis, who did not trust the local Aboriginal people and
didn't probably wished they had.
Yeah. So, from the very beginning, going back to the original settlement in 1788, from the very beginning, the impact on the Aboriginal population was pretty significant, even in 1788. So the Aboriginal population of the Sydney area, probably about 3,000 people. And the first governor, Philip, arrived with 1,300 convicts. So here are his I told you what he wanted to do, but here are his official instructions. To endeavor by every possible means to open an intercourse with the natives and to conciliate their affections, enjoining all our subjects to live in amity and kindness with them. Rather surprising.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, not quite as good as not showing up in the first place, but, you know, as a distant second, it's, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And Philip himself seems to have wanted to get along with the Aboriginal people as well as possible. But smallpox broke out in 1789, killing one settler and about half of the indigenous people in the area. There's controversy about the source of the outbreak. Some historians say that it came from Indonesia, spread along Aboriginal trade routes. Others say that the settlers spread it. Some say deliberately. But in the period from the 1820s to 1860, it managed to spread all over Australia. And the estimated mortality rate from smallpox was, on first exposure, 60%. 50% in the tropics and 25% in the interior, which was much drier. And smallpox was only one of the diseases that arrived. Measles, influenza, typhoid, tuberculosis, venereal diseases, you know, all of which high death rates and continued depopulation, particularly the venereal diseases, right? And of course, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say there's like a, actually, why don't you say this and then I'll jump in immediately after you.
Okay. Well, I mean, we've seen the impact of disease elsewhere in earlier episodes, but there was also direct conflict. Originally, the Aboriginal people seem to have been curious about the settlement. I mean, there's a lot of very novel things going on there, but they learned to avoid the settlers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There, in Dark Emu and the largest estate on Earth, there's a passage about some of these initial explorers or early people who landed. They kind of made fun of the sounds that Aboriginal people made. They kept making some repetitive gesture and some repetitive word that they were saying, and it turns out they were basically saying "go away." There's nothing here, go away.
Yeah. And Governor Philip was really eager to learn the language and customs of the Aboriginal people, so he had several of them kidnapped. He also seems to have, I'll leave Philip alone for the moment. Governor Macquarie wanted to civilize the Aboriginal people, so in 1815 he began elementary education for them, granted them land, which is odd on a whole number of levels, right? So you're going to grant them their own land. That's interesting. But even the idea that, wait, you're granting them land by British law?
Yeah, there's a quote about Macquarie here. He from Hughes. Macquarie hoped that they could be brought from their rambling, naked state and made into farmers. In 1815, he tried to put 16 Aboriginal men on a small farm on Sydney Harbour, complete with huts and a boat. They lost the boat, ignored the huts, and wandered off into the bush. From then on, it was assumed that native labor was useless, hence the rights normally assigned to colonized native workers within the empire were not extended to the Aborigines.
Yeah, yeah. Macquarie's also the one who initiated an annual native feast at Parramatta, which, you know, makes me wonder, what did you think this was going to lead to? Is this some kind of Thanksgiving celebration or binding of the cultures? And, you know, it's a story that we've heard and seen elsewhere before, right? British ideas of property and ownership conflicting with Aboriginal ideas of communal ownership, hunting rights seen as poaching, the kidnapping of Aboriginal men, women, and children, reprisal attacks, collective punishments, and both sides, right? And then a period of sustained Aboriginal attacks on the settlers, burning of crops, mass killing of livestock, trying to get them to leave, go away, as you say, unsuccessfully. The colony spread northwest of Sydney, bringing them into conflict with the Darug people from 1794 to 1810. Those people were led by Pumulwuy and later by his son, who was named Tedbury. So organized resistance, they burned crops, as I said, killed livestock, raided settler huts and stores. This is a pattern of resistance that was to be repeated over and over again as the colonial frontier expanded. Military garrison established on the Hawkesbury River in 1795, and continued warfare. Death toll from the last years, 1794 to 1800, last years of the century, 26 settlers and about 200 of the Darug people. And then the colony expanded southwest into the country of the Darawal. And after several settlers died there, Governor Macquarie sent three military expeditions into Darawal lands, culminating in the Appin Massacre of 1816. At least 14 Aboriginal people killed. So as I say, pretty familiar pattern. Expansion into Aboriginal lands, resistance, massacres.
And it's like, it's the U.S. kind of pattern. But I was going to say, like, the punitive raid thing you think of as being heavily associated with Scramble for Africa. But this is way before.
Way before.
It's a long, long running pattern. Yeah.
Yeah. From 1822 to 24, the colony spread into the lightly wooded pasture land west of the Great Dividing Range. And this opened the way for large-scale farming and grazing in the country of the Wiradjuri. Windradin led a group of 50 to 100 Aboriginal men raiding livestock, raiding the huts of the stockmen. About 15 to 20 colonists were killed. Martial law declared in 1824. Windradin and 260 of his followers ended their armed resistance. How many Aboriginal people died in the conflict? Estimates are pretty low, 15 to 100.
And Windradin, like, signed something at the end?
I think they simply came in and agreed to end their armed resistance.
Right. So it's interesting because it's, yeah, like, as far as the Aboriginal attitude towards all this is, you know, exactly what you would expect. There's a Captain Bellinghausen who was apparently Russian. Sounds like a German name, but I guess there's German Russians kind of thing.
Plenty of Germans in Russian service. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's Bellinghausen and he says, "The natives remember very well their former independence. Some express their claims to certain places, asserting they belong to their ancestors, despite all the compensation offered to them," which Hughes puts an exclamation mark in. "A spark of vengeance still smolders in their hearts." You would think it would, yeah. And Hughes says, "The government simply declared all Australian land to be crown land, and the idea that Aborigines might have some territorial rights by virtue of prior occupation was settled to the entire satisfaction of the whites by a New South Wales court decision in 1836, which declared that the Aborigines were too few and too ill organized to be considered free and independent tribes who owned the land they lived on." So you go to a settler court and you get a settler decision, I guess.
Interesting how short a time it took to change the attitude, right? Landing in 1788, let's be nice to the Aboriginal people, try to win them over. Well, of course, civilize them, but, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. Let's be nice. And 48 years later, yeah. The experience of Tasmania was, the descriptions I read are even worse. The settlers hunted kangaroos with dogs, and there were outbreaks of violence until 1824, by which time the colonist numbers were rapidly increasing, and so were the numbers of sheep, with the environmental and economic pressure on Aboriginal people that obviously creates. And this led to the Black War.
Yeah. So Reynolds, Henry Reynolds' book about Aboriginal resistance, called The Other Side of the Frontier. And he quotes a person, someone named G.A. Robinson, who was writing diaries at the time of the Black War. Robinson said the Tasmanian people have a tradition amongst them that white men have usurped their territory, driven them into the forests, have killed their game, have ravished their wives and daughters, have murdered and butchered their fellow countrymen, and are wont, whilst brooding over these complicated ills in the dense part of the forest, to goad each other to acts of bloodshed and revenge for the injuries done to their ancestors and the persecutions offered to themselves through their white enemies. So,
yeah,
he sort of says it as like, can you believe that the native people believe this stuff? But I think it probably was.
Well, he was. Robinson was kind of I don't know what you would call him, the leader of the peace mission. He went on a series from 1830 to 1834. He went on a series of friendly missions to the Aboriginal tribes with Aboriginal ambassadors along, trying to end this Black War. So did he? Was he being entirely sarcastic with that? I'm not sure.
I don't think he was being sarcastic. I think it was more like, listen, white people, you're not going to just pacify these people easily, because this is their perception of what's happening. Whatever you perceive to be happening, this is their perception. So
yeah,
I think he was aware that this was what was really happening, but it's like, when you're making the case for peace, you often have to say, like, look, reality doesn't matter, perception matters, that kind of argument. That's what I read it.
Okay. Yeah. Umara, the leader of the North Midlands people, was captured in 1828. He said it was his patriotic duty to kill as many white people as possible because they'd driven his people off their traditional hunting grounds.
Yeah.
And this is reminiscent of Kitchener in South Africa. The conflict got bad enough that martial law was declared and a black line was created. So around 2,200 soldiers and settlers swept the island in order to drive the Aboriginal population from the districts that they were settling or wanted to settle. So in this Black War, 200 settler and 330 Aboriginal Tasmanian deaths recorded 1803 to 34, but there's no way of knowing how many Aboriginal deaths went unreported.
Right. It reminds me, like, when we were talking about long time ago during the Civilization series, how the British didn't do a treaty process in Australia, right? They didn't.
No.
They didn't like how that went in the Americas. So they just, in one stroke, they were like, this is all crown land, whatever. I guess this is Reynolds again, or this might be Hughes, but a long quote, which is pretty good about this pattern. He says, at every contact with the Aborigines, the pattern would be much the same. A collision between a white culture of private property and a black one of primitive communism, in which no resources, land least of all, were privately owned. Sometimes the Aborigines would move on. Usually they attacked, launching a small guerrilla war until enough of their warriors had been cut down by settlers' firearms to render the tribe helpless. If their resistance was strong enough, martial law could be declared against them. In 1824, the stockholders around Bathurst persuaded Governor Brisbane to send soldiers in to pacify the Aborigines in the area. Brisbane, who a few years before had been impressing missionaries with his liberal expressions of concern for the Aborigine, saying things like, if something is not done for these poor, distressed creatures, they will become extinct. The race of them will perish from absolute want. He dispatched his troopers and native police, and the death toll was not tallied. Hughes also cites Reynolds as follows. This is interesting about the kind of warfare. Reynolds says, the Aborigines' tactical superiority was generally, if reluctantly, admitted by whites. Aborigines stole guns and learned how to use them. They made devastating attacks on sheep and cattle, harassed miners, killed horses, and burned homesteads, thus undercutting the economic basis of many areas of white settlement. While conflict was ubiquitous, so this is, he's also understanding, like, trying to analyze why the Aborigines couldn't hold the land, why they eventually lost most of these battles. Reynolds says, while conflict was ubiquitous in traditional societies, territorial conquest was virtually unknown. If Aborigines did not react to the initial invasion of their country, it was because they were not aware it had taken place. They certainly did not believe that their land had suddenly ceased to belong to them and they to their land. The mere presence of Europeans, no matter how threatening, could not uproot certainties so deeply implanted in Aboriginal custom and consciousness. So it's like, psychologically, they just couldn't understand what these Europeans were talking about. And they're also the ecological aspect, right? The destruction of their hunting environment. Hughes says, sheep and cattle drove out kangaroos and other game. Fences blocked ancient routes and runs. The forests were cut back. Familiar plants died out. And Gamage also talks about storing. So the role of storing as a logistical advantage for Europeans. Gamage says, storing is an immense military advantage. It releases people from a constant food quest, letting individuals and armies stay in the field. Except in parts of Asia, no people successfully resisted European occupation, but farmers and storers held out longer and won better compromises. People stored in 1788, but not to dependence, perhaps especially after epidemics, in effect, doubled resources. Many a shepherd survived siege with hut, gun, powder, and flour, whereas time and again, Aborigines holding a military advantage over Europeans had to disperse for food. Stores negated mobility. The plodding newcomer might be slow, but sooner or later, he got there. So,
yeah.
Kind of an interesting analysis, military analysis of it.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the Aboriginal people didn't have, you know, towns and villages that you could go in and destroy and condemn them to starvation. But the end result was the same. Right, you're
exactly
encroaching on their food supply and
fencing,
destroying, you know, the balance in the economy. Yeah. This happened in Victoria in the 1830s. 80 settlers and 1,000 to 1,500 Aboriginal people died in conflicts from 1835 to 1853. Same in the Swan River Colony. There was a mounted police force there. Punitive expedition led to the Pinjara massacre.
So Mounties before Canadian Mounties.
I'm not sure what they were called.
Yeah.
Sheep and cattle farming expanded, and that led to mounted police with revolvers, and by the middle of the century, breech-loading guns. And here's some intertribal conflicts. Some clans were being forced off their lands into the territory of other groups. But, you know, that's just a drop in the bucket. It's estimated that of the 8,000 Aboriginal people who died in Victoria in the 1830s and to 50s, only 200 were from intertribal violence.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Hughes's figures are the long frontier war killed between 2,000 and 2,500 Europeans and 20,000 Aborigines.
But these Aboriginal groups are very small. Maybe the reason the British didn't negotiate treaties with them was the size of the different groups. They're too small and there are too many of them. But that means that what a few hundred are killed,
it's sometimes the whole nation.
Yeah, it's a massive number of people.
Yeah. So there's an emblematic massacre that Hughes presents in The Fatal Shore called the Myall Creek Massacre, 1838. And so the white people claim that it was a reprisal for cattle theft. And I'll just read the whole passage. It's gruesome. I'm going to warn you, but it's, you know, just one description of what one of these massacres was like. So the station hands, who had no idea who the actual cattle rustlers culprits were, but they found an inoffensive encampment of Aborigines some 40 miles from the site and attacked them. A dozen armed stockmen, led by a white who kept company with the little tribe for the previous 3 weeks, rounded up 28 unarmed men, women, and children, roped them together, drove them to a killing ground nearby, and slaughtered them all with muskets and cutlasses. Then they chopped some up and mutilated others, burned the corpses on a pyre. But as it happened, there was a white witness among the killers who turned informer against the other 11. Although the jury in their first trial acquitted them all, a second trial produced verdicts of guilty for 7 of them who were hanged. 4 went free. The case was politically explosive. Probably it would never have come to court at all had Governor George Gipps not intervened directly. As no treaties with Aborigines existed, Gipps concluded they had never been in possession of any code of laws intelligible to civilized people, but maintained that in putting the law into force against the Aborigines, the utmost degree of mercy and forbearance should be exercised. It's interesting. So, like, charity, we don't have to, but we, you know, we should be, because we're good people. Settlers had exterminated thousands of Aborigines before, but none had swung for it. So acute was the resentment of this sentimental interference with the code of the frontier that some graziers, led by a magistrate, even raised a defense fund for the murderers. Although the Meal Creek massacre caused a passing revulsion of public conscience, it did nothing to stop the majority of those who believed the Australian version of manifest destiny, that it is the order of nature that as civilization advances, savage nations must be exterminated, and that the safety of explorers and settlers should not be sacrificed out of deference to political and humbugging maniacs who write and prate of matters of which they know nothing whatsoever. So he's quoting one of these newspapers. Sydney newspaper in 1883 writes, "If by one decisive step the Aborigines are shown their own weakness and convinced that it is useless for them to contend with Europeans, they will submit and cease their outrages and much bloodshed may be spared. Unless prompt measures are adopted, these dusky lords of the soil will fairly drive the pale faces from their territories." That's an interesting contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
They have to be shown their weakness, otherwise they're going to kick us all out of the land. They're so weak that unless we can show them how weak they are, they'll throw us all out. And, you know, there's he kind of addresses the idea that that there couldn't really, why there wasn't solidarity between the convicts and the Aboriginal people. Hughes says the idea that the despised Aborigine might have had some natural sympathy with the oppressed convict is the flimsiest sentiment across the cultural chasm that separated them. No such alliances were possible and none were ever made except for a few convicts who escaped and successfully adapted to tribal life. Other things that happened, there's mass poisonings. There was a mass poisoning of Aborigines in Kilcoy Station in 1842. Reynolds also points out this whole thing about how Aborigines didn't start fighting Europeans right away. They sometimes there was like a whole generation, as in Tasmania. But another Reynolds has some pretty cool stuff about how Aboriginal people fought back. So he says Aboriginal clans usually knew in advance what European parties were doing and simply avoided contact. White numbers were too small to scour the country thoroughly, while settlers could not afford the luxury of long patrols, which took workers away from productive work. Kind of reminds me of the way the Nama fought the Germans, right? Mm-hmm. Even the Queensland native police seems to have spent most of its time in fruitless patrolling without seeing any Aborigines. Clans were most vulnerable when they were in camp, and punitive parties often endeavored to advance on them in the darkness and attack at first light. White tactics sometimes succeeded, but the failure rate was certainly very high. Aborigines were inured to fear of night attack from their tribal enemies. It was in consequence hard to take a camp by surprise, especially for clumsy and heavy-booted Europeans. Many measures were adopted to counter nocturnal danger. Fires were not lit, kept so small they could not be seen in the distance or shielded by screens of saplings. Without the distant glow of campfires, sleeping Aborigines were almost impossible to find. Campsites were chosen on the edge of rivers and swamps or forests among broken and boulder-strewn country to expedite flight, and there are numerous accounts of European parties galloping into camps that had already been vacated. Aborigines were acutely observant, and their camps were usually surrounded by dogs, keen from hunger, who provided an effective early warning system.
Yeah, some cool notes there. We could have gone into great detail of a number of cases. I think covering the Mile Massacre that way is, as long as you realize that that's not an isolated case, that's
sample.
More, yeah. And I think what this made me too was the last recorded massacre of Aboriginal people by settlers at Coniston in the Northern Territory, 1928. 31 Aboriginal people were killed.
Wow, that's really late.
Really late. Some governors tried to protect Aboriginal people. There were officials called protectors of Aborigines were appointed in South Australia in 1839 and Western Australia in 1840. So the idea was to extend the protection of British law to Aboriginal people. But more often, what it did was increase their criminalization. Protectors were also made responsible for the distribution of rations, for the delivery of elementary education to Aboriginal children, instruction in Christianity, and sometimes training in occupations that would be useful to the colonists. This led to reserves, Christian missions, government stations, which provided housing and rations and schools. But by 1857, the protection offices were closed because of their cost and the failure to meet their goals, which weren't especially lofty, but they didn't meet those anyway. So in New South Wales, 116 reserves were established between 1860 and 1894. Most reserves allowed Aboriginal people freedom to enter and leave, a certain degree of autonomy, I guess you could say. But by contrast, the Victoria Board for the Protection of Aborigines in 1869 had the power, extensive powers, to regulate employment, education, and place of residence of Aboriginal people. And there were 5 reserves there, and they were closely managed. And they also excluded half-caste Aboriginal people from the missions and stations.
Wow, they called them half-caste?
Already, yeah. So this is a forerunner of the racial segregation policies of several governments in Australia from the 1890s. So it's a rather interesting mix of Canadian and South African approaches, right? Reserves, but also racial segregation.
Yeah.
There was a gold rush in Australia in 1851. The population increased from 430,000 to almost 1.2 million in the space of a decade. Victoria became the most populous colony, Melbourne the largest city. 20,000 Chinese miners came in to work in the gold fields by 1855, 13,000 more in the New South Wales diggings. And the belief quickly spread widely that these Chinese miners represented a danger to white Australians, to their standard of living, to their standards of morality. So colonial governments responded by imposing a range of taxes and restrictions on Chinese migrants and residents. There were anti-Chinese riots on the Victorian goldfields in 1856 and in New South Wales in 1860.
Wow, Australia is way ahead of Canada. Canada didn't have those until 1885.
Yeah.
But they also, I mean, it's interesting, right? Because it's like a lot of these probably were kidnapped laborers, because this is like just 10, 12 years, 15 years after the Opium War. And they didn't, as far as I know, the British didn't start this whole Chinese labor process until after the Opium War, right?
I'm not sure how they were recruited. I don't know if they could kidnap numbers like that.
Shanghaied? Yeah, you're right. That's pretty big numbers.
I'm sure the wages are better than what they would be. And also they're escaping the you know, the political violence in China. Beware of what you wish for.
Yeah.
There was a an interesting episode from the Gold Rush, the Eureka stockade. So there were more men moving into the gold fields and progressively less gold for those men to find. And the government charged a flat fee, a monthly license fee. So there were protests in 1854 against that fee, and the men on the gold fields were demanding voting rights. A few of the protesters were arrested, and that encouraged many of the rest to build themselves a little fort, a stockade, on the Eureka gold field. Troops were sent in. There was a fight. 5 soldiers and 20 protesters were killed. So there was a royal commission to investigate this, and the monthly license fee was replaced with an annual miner's license or right at a lower cost. And that gave holders of the license the right to vote and to build a house or a dwelling on the goldfields. And the administration of the Victorian goldfields was also reformed. So according to Stuart MacIntyre, the Eureka Rebellion was a formative event in the national mythology. The Southern Cross on the protesters' flag, the Eureka flag, became a symbol of freedom and independence. But according to A.G.L. Shaw, the Eureka affair, here's, I quote, is often painted as a great fight for Australian liberty and the rights of the working man. But it was not that. Its leaders were themselves small capitalists, and even after universal suffrage was introduced, only about a fifth of the miners bothered to vote. So I just found it interesting that the Australians have their own historical myths, just like Americans and Canadians. But this, I guess, resistance against the government going back to the early convicts is a thread in Australian history. And another thread is the idea of the bush rangers. So the first bush rangers were escaped convicts. If they could get away and then go into the bush and manage to live independently, they could, you know, live free. So there's an association in Australian minds, or in Australian mythology, if you wish, between the bush and freedom. And impoverished small farmers sometimes turn to crime. There's the famous Kelly gang. I don't know if you ever heard of Ned Kelly, but the exploits of Ned Kelly and his gang got a lot of local community support and rather extensive coverage in the press at the time. He was like a national figure. Bit of a Robin Hood, bit of a, I don't know, sometimes he reminds me of American gangsters from the Depression, right? Bonnie and Clyde, or maybe Wild West outlaws like Jesse James and Billy the Kid. I don't know enough about the original guy, just that they made movies about him later. He was captured and executed for murder in 1880. But again, his story inspired works of art, literature, film, and there's a debate about the guy. You know, to what extent was he a rebel fighting against social injustice and the oppressions of the police and the government? And to what extent was he just a murderous criminal? And it reminds me of the love affair between Americans and their criminals and gangsters and outlaws, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's and when you remember how much the Germans were excited by that U.S. Wild West, you know, novels and their that culture.
Yeah, but the gangster thing, I don't know that Canada has the same love affair with outlaws and criminals. I mean, there's the Black Donnellys, but that's...
Yeah, I don't know much about Canadian. There's nothing that like comes to mind about like glamorous bank robbers or whatever.
No, no.
So some of the Aboriginal and ecological consequences, to kind of bring it full circle, that Reynolds estimates that the Aboriginal population was about 300,000 in 1788 and went down to 50,000 a century later. So this was 1981. I imagine what happens to estimates of pre-contact Aboriginal populations always is that they always go up. and how long ago they were here also always gets pushed further back. Like they were here longer and there were more of them. But anyway, in 1981, it was thought that that was the nature of the demographic collapse. And Gamage quotes Alfred Howitt, who was talking about eucalyptus trees, gave a lecture to the Royal Society of Victoria on eucalyptus trees in Gippsland. And in 1890, this Alfred Howitt, I don't know anything about Alfred Howitt, but he argued that by ending the Aboriginal practices of using fire to manage land, the open forests had been replaced with impassable bush, insect populations had exploded and killed whole forests, and the hardening of the ground also made the trees die of thirst and made floods worse. So Gamage's conclusions are pretty interesting. He says, important books wait on pre-contact management in other lands, but only in Australia did a mobile people organize a continent with such precision. In some past time, probably distant, their focus tipped from land use to land care. They sanctioned key principles. Think long term, leave the world as it is. Think globally, act locally, ally with fire, control population. So yeah, Dave, I guess Gamage does think that they were pretty, explicit, conscious about controlling population. Mm-hmm. They were active, not passive, striving for balance and continuity to make all life abundant, convenient, and predictable. They put the mark of humanity firmly on every place. They kept the faith. The land lived. Its face spoke. Here are managers, it said, caring, provident, hardworking. This is possession in its most fundamental sense. If terra nullius exists anywhere in our country, it was made by Europeans. So that's pretty
cool. Oh, interesting.
Pretty cool.
I just checked out Howitt. Interesting connection. He was the leader of the expedition searching for what happened to Burke and Willis.
That's great. And then he learned something about the eucalyptus tree.
Well, he was an anthropologist as well as the leader of the expedition. So,
Now back to Reynolds, the other side of the frontier, 1981. He's writing basically to a white audience, and he's got a very interesting argument here that he's making, Dave. He says this in his conclusions. In the long run, black Australians will be our equals or our enemies. Unless they can identify with new and radical interpretations of our history, they will seek sustenance in the anti-colonial traditions of the Third World. Uh-oh. We better stop that from happening, right? If they are unable to find a place of honor in the white man's story of their past, their loyalties will increasingly dwell with the wretched of the earth. That's, I guess, some kind of Frantz Fanon reference. Mm. But if the Aboriginal experience is to be woven into new interpretations of Australian history, changes will be necessary. We will have to deal with the blacks. It's funny. It's just funny, this 1981 kind of language and politics. But he says, we'll have to deal with, I'm going to call them the Aborigines. The Aborigines as equals, or they will see our sudden interest in their history as merely another phase of our intellectual usurpation of their culture and traditions. We must give due weight to Aboriginal perceptions of ourselves, and they will not be flattering. Aborigines have seen so much of the dark underside of white Australia. They have lived with it for 200 years. Aborigines believe that Europeans are hypocrites. You are very clever people, an old tribesman told W.E.H. Stanner. Very hard people, plenty humbug. In Aboriginal eyes, the whites were invaders who came preaching the virtues of private property, people who talked much of British justice while unleashing a reign of terror and behaving like an ill-disciplined army of occupation once the invasion was effected. fornicators, who pursued black women in every fringe camp on the continent, but in daylight disowned both lovers and resulting offspring. So, you know, first of all, there's like I think it's a really honest and a really harsh, you know, statement. But I also think it's funny that the big threat is that they're going to see themselves as an oppressed colony unless we change our ways. And the rest of the conclusion is nice too. He says, white Australians frequently say that all that should be forgotten, but it will not be. It cannot be. Black memories are too deeply, too recently scarred, and forgetfulness is a strange prescription coming from a community which has revered the fallen warrior and emblazoned the phrase, lest we forget, on monuments throughout the land. Canada, you could say the same about Canada. So yeah. Our embarrassment is compounded. Do we give up our cherished ceremonies, or do we make room for the Aboriginal dead on our memorials, cenotaphs, boards of honor, and even in the pantheon of national heroes? If we are to continue to celebrate the sacrifice of men and women who died for their country, can we deny admission to fallen tribesmen? They were ever the underdogs. They were always outgunned, yet frequently faced death without flinching. If they did not die for Australia as such, they fell defending their homelands, their sacred sites, and their way of life. What is more, the Aborigines bled on their own soil and not half a world away, furthering the strategic objectives of a distant motherland whose influence must increasingly be seen as of transient importance in the history of this continent.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's pretty good, eh? Why is this like part of our scramble episodes? Seems to me we have racial ideology, we have the ideology of inferior tribes destined to die out, we have a whole thing about savages who don't know anything and live in wilderness, we have the exploration, moving into Aboriginal lands, encroachment, violence. What else?
With a couple of differences, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty hard to look at the history of white Australia without convicts.
Yeah, yeah.
I find many, many similarities between Canadians and Australians, many similarities between our history, but there are some significant differences. I mean, the image of the bush in Australia and its connection to freedom, where for Canadians, you know, we have a pretty vast bushland, which... Yeah. We see as more of a, you know, get out of the city, you know, playground for hunting, fishing, and cottaging, rather than going off the grid to escape the oppressive government. There's also the differences between, I guess, the history of the Métis versus, you know, the treatment of half-caste Aboriginal people. And I'm certainly not going to hold up Canada's immigration policies as a model of, you know, fairness or anything like that. We had our anti-Asian riots and our embarrassing episodes, some of which we'll bring up again in future. But there's no question that Australian immigration policies are pretty world famous for
how they have some kind of camp, right? They have some kind of really nasty camp I was reading about.
Well, even in the 1980s, that, you know, it was still pretty much white immigrants only, and it was fairly blatant and pretty restrictive. I don't know what the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation approach will yield in terms of, you know, significant results, but, you know, I wonder to what extent Australia is moving towards that, or if they'll have it.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, we definitely have our criticisms of the TRC here, but I do think that it has been a net benefit or net positive process for the country.
Yeah. Certainly not finished, but
yeah. So, and then the other reason I guess we're talking about this is because, as we'll find in future episodes, that Australia is some kind of base for the other scramble for Oceania.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're not done with Australia in that sense. And certainly Australia was just the first step towards New Zealand, our next episode.
All right. Stay tuned, people.